You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello out there in archaeology podcast land. This is Dr. Alan Garfinkel. I'm the president and founder of the California Rock Art Foundation. And what we do is we identify, evaluate, manage, and conserve rock art both in Alta California and in Baja California. We conduct field trips, we have trainings, exercise, we do research, and in every way possible, we try to preserve, protect, and coordinate treasures of Alta and Baja California rock art, of which there are many and diverse. We also work closely with Native Americans and partner with them to recognize and protect sacred sites. So for more info about the fabulous California Rock Art Foundation, you can go to carockart.org. Also, I'm open to give me a call, 805-312-2261. We would welcome sponsorship or underwriting, helping us to defray the costs of our podcasts, and also membership in California Rock Art Foundation. And of course, donations, since we are a 501c3 nonprofit scientific and educational corporation. God bless everyone out there in podcast land.
You're listening to the Rock Art Podcast. Join us every week for fascinating tales of rock art, adventure, and archaeology. Find our contact info in the show notes and send us your suggestions.
Hello out there in archaeology podcast land. This is your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel. Get ready for episode 127 with Rayette Martin, who is the executive director of the Nevadans for Cultural Preservation. She will thrill you with her stories of rock art adventure and graffiti remediation. She is someone I've just gotten to know in the last week or so. Rayette, are you there?
I am. I'm so happy to be here and also get to know you a little bit more as well.
Thank you, Rayette. It's a pleasure. So I think before we launch into anything else, maybe give them a thumbnail sketch of what Nevadans for Cultural Preservation is all about. I looked through your website just a few moments ago, and it sounds like you've got a very strong educational platform, correct?
Yes, our main thing is preservation through education. And we're really founded on the belief that we cannot expect people to care for things they know nothing about, follow laws they've never heard of, or protect things they cannot identify. And the nonprofit was really born out of my experience working with the Nevada Site Stewardship Program. And that program is run by the State Historic Preservation Office, and they educate volunteers to go out and monitor at-risk archaeological sites for damage and change, and then that information goes to the land manager and their archaeologists so that they can take action if need be. And in California, there's a similar program. It's the California Archaeological Site Stewardship Program. But while I was working there, I was noticing that a lot of the damages were things that maybe people just didn't know they should be doing or not doing. So things like children who had scratched tic-tac-toe underneath some petroglyphs and that type of thing. So we thought, hey, we really need a program to go out and educate folks on not only what's out there, but why it's important and then why we take care of it.
That's fabulous. Yeah, I'm somewhat familiar with the program of site stewardship in California. At least I met the couple that have been doing that for many, many years. Mm-hmm. I think through a particular adjunct of the Society for California Archaeology, at least that's what I understood. And certainly the California Rock Art Foundation is attempting to sort of your twin to do some of this education work that we're talking about as well. And we can talk about that further in this episode. I think first to kick off though, and this is something that I do each episode, tell us a bit about how you ever came to be involved with this niche. This, I understand you're an archaeologist, but how did you get from, you know, get that interest and that passion in this particular specialty? It's rather uncommon, isn't it?
It is. So it's a long story, so I'll make it as short as possible. So I grew up in Alaska, and I was a big PBS kid. I was always watching programs about different places and cultures and things like that. And then I ended up kind of falling into college because I had worked enough jobs that I wanted to do something different. And I, you know, started off wanting to work with people and solve problems, and got a heavy emphasis in cultural anthropology. My thesis was ordered identities, class, ethnicity, and transnational social networks. So
now, yeah. Wait a second. Now that yeah. is, I mean, that is a mouthful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's some of the best, you know, wordsmithing and anthropological, archaeological psychobabble I've heard in a while. God bless you, yeah. Raya.
Thanks. I moved far away from that. And uh-huh. I got my, my master's degree at UNLV, and then started at that stewardship program right away. And my okay. hobbies and interests really aligned with going in the outdoors, taking care of, you know, cultural sites and hiking and off-roading. And so I was a good fit to work with the public. And so if you had to term or put a label on what I do, I would say I'm more of a public archaeologist. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. I've had 10 years of experience, you know, relocating sites, educating land managers on their sites and how to take care of them, mm-hmm. doing trainings and that kind of thing. So I'm an educator. I'm passionate about caring for cultural sites. And then also there's a little bit of art involved, and that comes in with our graffiti remediation and other work that we do.
Fabulous. So it sounds like, you know, we were living, Rayette, in parallel worlds, because, you know, my passion and the California Rock Art Foundation's passion is to be involved in those same things vis-a-vis education and stewardship, conservation, protection, documentation, and working with sort of state-of-the-art elements to marry sort of a field trip experience with a set of seminars or educational elements to teach people the value and the significance and what we think we know or might know about these resources. Does that make any sense?
No, it makes total sense. That's exactly what we're doing. And then, you know, you have different audiences that you cater that education to. So a lot of the work that I do is with the public who may not even be aware of the resources that we have.
Right. Exactly. Now that audience, that larger audience, we have attempted to capture, and this might be of great interest to you, there is a function that occurs annually in a place called Ridgecrest, California. And Ridgecrest is sort of ground zero for Coso rock art. But they have a thing called the Petroglyph Festival. And it's been going on for 10 years. And it brings between 5 and 10,000 people for a two-day event there in Ridgecrest.
It's amazing.
Yeah. And they have, you know, a lot of vendors, but they also have a powwow that's going on at the same time. And so they have exhibitors and dancers and educations, and they have, you know, entertainment and food and all kinds of stuff. So all that and much more. And their platform has always been to try to reach out to the youngsters if they could, even with a companion sort of educational environment, and teach them the value of sort of the Native American heritage resources. So there's all of that and much more. They also created a thing called Petroglyph Park. and there they did replicas of rock art that was there within the China Lake vicinity, right there near Ridgecrest, but also around the world. And they brought in tons of rock, tons. And they sometimes replicated it by painting, but also by engraving, mm-hmm. and mirroring the imagery that appears on rock art all around the world.
That's fantastic. I think it's really important for people who may not be the adventure risk type and go out and hike and go relocate these things to have access to that. So I think that's amazing.
The other thing that they do is they have this thing called the Welcome Center. And so there's welcome centers all over California. So when someone is trying to get information about how to get to Death Valley or what can I do that I'm here in Ridgecrest, they go to this welcome center. Well, in this welcome center, there's an exhibit, right? And the exhibit has several headsets, virtual reality headsets. And so they can put on a VR headset and boom, they're in a little Petroglyph Canyon and can walk through the canyon with a walking tour with Dr. Alan Garfinkel Gold here, helping them to understand what they're seeing. Or they can put on another headset and be in the Arctic, be in China, be in Europe, and be in the American Southwest, seeing cultural resources. And VR has become so, the sophistication and the resolution of VR using these headsets is scary because you can reach out in a three-dimensional way and literally feel like you're right there. It's you move your head and it has a rotational thing so you can look, you know, almost 24/7 around in a circle and up and down, and it you see everything. And you can see the grains of sand in the rock itself. That's the kind of resolution they have. It blows your mind. We happen to have one of the world's experts in VR who's a board member of the California Rock Art Foundation. Otherwise, he wouldn't have, you know, had any access to anything like this. So it's interesting. And as you're well aware, this discipline is changing radically from moment to moment.
Most definitely. So one of the things that the nonprofit does is we write grant projects. And there's a funding source called the Lincoln County Archaeological Initiative. And because they have these funds, they're from the BLM sale of lands, they can fund amazing work like that. And we are, hopefully, we've got our proposal out to bring that type of product that already exists into the community in Lincoln County, which is a small community north of Las Vegas. And I think, yeah, that's the future for sure.
And I know that Lincoln County, you know, rock art granting and the associated rock art that's there rather well. I have a colleague who I worked with years ago and published made a presentation. His name was Farrell Lytle. Do you know him? He is in Pioche, Nevada.
I do. I love Farrell.
There you go. There you go. Yeah. Farrell's a longtime colleague of mine, and we worked together to do the dating of rock art. And using his portable XRF efforts, we dated Coso rock art, but he also dated other rock art, including the rock art there in Lincoln County. And that particular strategy has been pursued by others and taken to and elevated. There's a gentleman of German ethnicity and ancestry who works with a world famous think tank. He's a chemist and other areas, and he's done XRF experimental rock art dating all over the world. Published three papers. One, I'm a co-author on the COSO stuff, but he's done two other papers, one on his work in the Great Basin. I don't know. I think it's Utah more than Nevada. Yeah. And another one on his work in the Middle East. And he does the portable XRF as well. And he's coming back to California. Hopefully we have some funding for him to do further dating at the National Mojave Preserve in Eastern California, because there's very little dating on some of this grapevine style rock art that you're probably well aware of.
Yeah, the dating is one of the public's main interests as well. So whenever I'm engaging with the public talking about the importance, they always want to know when it happened.
Exactly. Yeah. Please tell me. Well, let's take a break for the first segment. See you in the flip-flop, gang. Welcome back, boys and girls. This is Dr. Alan Garfinkel, your host. This is segment 2 of episode 127 of your Rock Art podcast. And this time, we have Rayette Martin, Executive Director of Nevadans for Cultural Preservation. Welcome back, Rayette.
Thanks.
Let's get into some of the details, some of the actual activities that are underway for the Nevadans for Cultural Preservation. Can you share with us some of the programs and some of the perhaps the actual activities and elements that the nonprofit is actively involved with?
Sure, I'm happy to do that. We have a variety of different things that we're working on and have been working on. One of the main ones, since we're education focused, is outreach and engaging land users in exploring, reporting, and protecting our cultural sites. So I was able to get an Off-Highway Vehicles Commission grant. That's where people register their OHVs, and that money goes into a pot. And I applied for funds to create an OHV Preservation Ambassador Program. So there's a way for them to take a quick online training. And then when they're out exploring, like they do, and they come across something, they can scan a QR code and just report what they found. And they can also adopt sites that they may have gone out to. So it's kind of like the stewardship program. However, we are not sharing site information with them. They're just telling us where they've been going and what may need attention. So that's an actual program. And then we also have been doing a lot of work with graffiti remediation. And that's been kind of a passion project of mine. And we've done that all across like the southern part of Nevada.
Tell us a bit more. I'm especially interested in this graffiti remediation because it is something that I've not had a lot of experience with. And I ran into a boulder in a park not far from me. I live in Bakersfield, California. And they asked us to remediate a tag, you know, a tag from a gang.
Yeah.
And it was on a granite boulder that also had a bedrock milling surface and a, you know, incipient bedrock mortar. And they said mm-hmm. that they would just use, you know, a high powered hose and the pressure washing would get rid of that particular tag. I didn't realize that would be possible. And I also didn't realize that would be an acceptable way of doing it. We worked with a Native American who was ethnically affiliated with the indigenous people who lived here in Bakersfield, a Yalumni Yokuts. And she thought that was a great idea. And they did do that. Now, they did relocate that boulder away from where it was in situ because mm-hmm. they wanted to protect it. They wanted to make sure that this didn't happen again. And they placed it in an area that is being used for interpretation in an interpretive facility on site. They just spent $1 million to put an interpretive facility on site in this park. And there, they're also going to have a native California plants, a sort of a garden there. And I think they're working on, hopefully, working with the native people and myself and others to do some public interpretation so that the people that visit the interpretive facility might understand the significance of these plants and what they meant to the native people and how that would work in with the archaeological record. So tell us a bit about this graffiti remediation issue. I imagine it's far more complex.
Yeah, it is. And I'm glad that you mentioned that the tribe was involved in the decision-making because that is what's of utmost importance. Is there's a lot of different ways that we can approach vandalism. Sometimes it's leave it how it is. Sometimes it's removing it. You know, it all of those come with pros and cons. Once something's vandalized, you can never get it back to its original state. So there are many, many different techniques. And then there's many different paints and rock surfaces and considerations to bring in. So there's not a one size fits all. And in addition to that, there's a lot of, as you're working on something, the rock surface changes within, you know, centimeters. as you're going. And so one thing will work in one spot and not in the other. What my experience has been is back in 2013, I got some training on removing scratches, you know, like when you have a rock and it leaves a little bit of like chalk behind, how to remove that. And then I sat down and was able to use mineral pigments to do some color matching to camouflage deeper scratched, like incised graffiti. And I found out that I could do that all day. Everybody's got a special skill, and mine is I can sit for 10 hours painting rocks. So yeah, you never know. Sorting.
All right.
No sorting lithics for me, but I can.
You love to paint rocks.
Yes. Didn't know. And it's kind of unarting, like I'm removing markings. So the strategy really is creating, and this is through Stratum Unlimited, who's been mentoring me, gentleman's Dr. Lobzer, is the art of creating chaos out of order. So when we think of graffiti removal or camouflage, a lot of times people want everything to be gone. I want it to go back to the way it was. But really, the main thing is to distract the eye from something that's recognizable. So the tag that you had, if you could see a straight line, you know, you want to be able to break up that straight line so your eye isn't drawn to it and that type of thing. So the first step is always knowing your surface, knowing what rock art is there, if it's petroglyphs, pictographs, really taking a detailed look and doing fine line tracings so that when you go in for any kind of technique, you're not impacting that. And then testing. It's a slow, tedious process, but once you find something that works, you kind of move through there.
So this technique does not necessarily remove the graffiti in all times. It sort of masks it, doesn't it? Am I hearing that or no?
Yeah, because for example, I worked on a site where we had a pictograph and somebody had spray painted over it and the rocks in giant black letters. So we were able to, we used wire brushes, drill with a wire to remove the paint and not the surface of the rock, because again, it was like hard granite as well. And it kind of smears it. Then we use a little chemical. We wipe up the smear until we get it faded to the point where you can't really tell it's there. And then on top of the actual pictographs, we didn't touch it. We didn't try and remove the paint itself. But in other instances, we've removed the paint on top of pictographs. So, but it will never come back. It will never be all the way back to normal.
But it will be remediated.
No longer visibly.
Right. To the eye. It won't be as offensive. And one can then aesthetically be a bit more appealing, I guess would be the answer, right?
Yeah. It brings your attention back to what's supposed to be drawn to, right? It brings it back to the pictograph or the petroglyph. So, because your eye will catch that. It's not going to catch the smear little bit of black that looks like part of the rock. It will go to the imagery.
Is there a rich literature published about these techniques and this particular method for remediation and dealing with graffiti? I have not found such in my own just preliminary research.
Right. And I honestly think that's because it is so specific to each situation. So but there's still a series of things you want to go through. So first, you want to record everything that you see there and like really get in there, use your de-stretch, get out your magnifying glass and find the boundaries of where the imagery is.
Okay.
Then you want to start with like really simple dry techniques. Sometimes just a dry paintbrush, right? Okay. Can remove some chalk or some charcoal. And then you use a rolling poultice, which is a cotton ball put on like a dowel, and you try it dry and then you try it wet and then you move up to a toothbrush and then you move up. So you just slowly go to, I don't want to call it invasive, but potentially, you know, rougher or more damaging.
Yeah, some sort of stronger or more invasive technology to try to do, to repair the damage.
Exactly.
Or ameliorate or mask.
Yeah, And so in one spot, it may brush off. The other spot, the rock's more porous, and now it's kind of part of the rock.
Right,
and you may have to use, you know, some chemical, like potassium hydroxide, to break up that bond and flush it out. But maybe we don't need to get there. So it's not like, hey, I have acrylic paint on top of Aztec sandstone. What do I do to fix that? I can't tell you.
There's very few people in the world that know about this, is there? I mean, in terms of expertise for, you know, graffiti remediation for rock art.
Yeah, it's a very small group of professionals. And each one of those professionals comes at it with a little bit of a different technique and may think what a successful case looks like is different from each other. So when looking for a professional to do this, you want to, you know, make sure you look at their portfolio and understand their mindset and how they want to go about it. There's technology with lasers now that can break up graffiti. But the problem with maybe lasering something off is now you went from having the graffiti your eye was attracted to now is the laser making lines? Can right. the laser feather it out and make it look natural? So is it removing the paint that you want to do, or is it distracting the eye enough to where, again, you're looking at the main attraction and causing the least amount of change to the rock surface? What is it you want?
And what do the natives have to say about this in terms of what you're doing? What is their, I know that every group would be different, but what has been their consensus from tribe to tribe about the activities of remediation of graffiti? Is it something they support? Is it something they find important and significant to their religious observations, or no?
So I can speak from, I just finished up a project outside the Las Vegas Valley. So I worked with the Las Vegas Southern Paiute tribe, and this area, it was damaged for over 30 years. So it was a big party spot, and people had layers and layers of spray paint, the trash, the burning, you know, how that goes. And so it was important to them to see the area cleaned up because it's like a symbol of respect for the area. And so they were very happy at the level of removal that I was able to accomplish. And again, I didn't remove every single thing, because now you can actually, we were able to uncover petroglyphs and pictographs that nobody knew were there because it hadn't been recorded before the damage occurred. So we found it as we were going. In some instances, you know, if you wait long enough, sometimes that little bit of damage fades. So they don't really want people to go out and start making a mess of it. But when it's a huge area that's covered extensively with graffiti, it's been very positively received. The same thing with historical scratching. You know, when an area is graffitied, whether it's scratching their name in something or spray painting it, it attracts more and more. And so you end up, if you don't take care of it right away, it becomes 50 years old or older. Now we got to deal with that. But also, you know, it keeps adding new things. And then the story of that area is no longer about the petroglyph panels. It's about, you know, the class of 1972 that came in and scratched over it. So,
yeah, we have a site that's right along the highway near Little Lake that's on private property, believe it or not, that was near a major transportation route for the last, you know, 100 years. There was a trail there, and now it's Highway 395, and it was, you know, the road was right there. So what you have there is advertising superimposed over prehistoric rock art. You've got advertising from the turn of the century, not 2000, but 1900. That where they were advertising. And then on top of that, you've got graffiti, both painted and actual scratched into it. And then you've got a lot of rock art. You probably have over 100 elements minimum. And looks like it. They should go back probably about 12,000 years all in this one little spot, which is interesting. And I've always wanted to develop some way to perhaps deal with that area and maybe try to develop some respect or education, because it's been hit so heavily. I think it probably would mirror the situation you dealt with in Las Vegas, because it's so, you know, it's so open and so readily available and so notable right there. Mm-hmm. So everybody and their uncle has put their name on there, and they've, so for the last 12,000 years, you've got rock imagery and you have advertising and graffiti and everything else all concatenated or conflated in this one little area. Is that something similar to what we're talking about?
That's more like an area that we have. It's an archaeological district that covers about 2,000 acres. It's called White River Narrows. And same thing, the old road used to go wind through that canyon. And we have the exact same issue. And in that case, through work of the Bureau of Land Management and the tribes and the State Historic Preservation Office, they agreed to remove some of the historic remove, quote unquote, you know, minimize some of that historic engraving and stuff so that, again, the rock imagery would be the main focal point. And so that was a decision that was made between all of those stakeholders. Yeah. So we were able to do that in that area.
Well, let me close out this segment and we'll move to the next one. Thanks so much, Rayette. See you in the flip-flop, gang. Well, welcome back, gang. This is your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel, and we'll round it up. This is segment 3 of your Rock Art podcast with Rayette Martin. Rayette, you were just saying during the break that there's one particular program of the Nevadans for Cultural Preservation that you have tremendous passion for and needs to be recognized by the general public. Please speak to that if you would.
Yeah, so I had talked, you know, real briefly in the first segment about having an OHV preservation ambassador program. But what I really want to highlight is that we have like a citizen stewardship pledge and a way for anybody to report damage they find on public lands across Nevada. So when you visit our website, which is nvfcp.org, you can go to action, take action, and report. And so it's through those citizen reports that we can then get out and address issues, whether that be graffiti remediation or, you know, making sure that erosion isn't going to take away a historic property and those types of things. So one of our main missions is not only educating folks, but providing them an opportunity to participate. And you don't have to sign up or do any special training to make sure that your voice is heard and the information that you come across can be shared.
And how is that done, Rayette? How would someone from the general public interact with your organization and inform them of something that they discovered?
So you can always give us a call, and that's 702-466-3013. It's my personal cell. We're a small organization. And we've partnered with the Nevada Site Stewardship Program, which I mentioned before, because they have full-time staff and it's their job to manage sites and reports. So when you come to our website and you want to do it anonymously, or it's a way for you to upload your pictures and that kind of thing, you just fill out a real simple online form and you hit submit. That form goes off to the State Historic Preservation Office, and your observations become part of the archaeological record for that site. And we make sure that the proper people get notified, because I know a lot of times you may be out recreating and you don't know if you're on BLM land, Bureau of Land Management, or if you're on Forest Service or National Park Service, or you might even be on a state park and you're not quite sure where the boundaries are. That doesn't matter. You can do like a one-stop shop, call me or go online and make a report, and we'll make sure the right people are notified.
That's fabulous. What did it take for you to sort of implement a program like that? How did that come about?
It started when I was working with the site stewardship program, because to become an official site steward, there's like a 6-hour training class. You have to sign confidentiality forms, and then you're assigned to a particular site. But being part of the off-road community myself, and hiking and doing that type of stuff. I know that the rest of us come across these sites pretty often, and the ones we come across are most likely the ones that are going to be damaged. So I figured if we made an online reporting form, then we could maximize our reach and get those folks involved so that we can expand our eyes and ears on the ground. And so it was a collaboration between the two organizations to make sure that these resources are available to the public so that they can report.
And how is SHPO involved with this, the State Historic Preservation Office?
Well, the nice thing is in the state of Nevada, there's a Nevada revised statute that mandates that the State Historic Preservation Office runs a Nevada site stewardship program. And there's funding through that so that there's always an administrator for that program. And then that way, say something happens to my organization, which it won't because we're doing amazing, but if it happens to, that will continue on no matter what.
Right. So it's funded and it's part of the government infrastructure for the state. Yeah, it's fabulous.
And then our nonprofit, because we are so small, we're not the ones that are constantly, you know, having to manage that data.
Right.
That's all already set up in a statewide system. So,
yeah, I think I understand.
So we're more of a partner.
Yeah. It looks like from your website that there's a number of people who are faculty members or people who have, you know, prominent placement in certain scholarly institutions. Tell me a bit about that as well, please.
Yeah, so our board of directors, so I'm the executive director and founding member, but the other members on our board were selected for that reason. We have the chair of the anthropology department at UNLV, Dr. Barbara Roth, because she comes with a different level of experience and expertise, but also has that education background. We have Dr. Kevin Rafferty, and he's well known for his background in rock art. And it was also from an education perspective. He's retired now, and so he has a little more time to help us out. And then we also have a non-voting position for the Nevada Site Stewardship Program, because that relationship is very important. And we have federal archaeologist Justin DeMeo, and he brings that level of CRM and working with the agencies that helps us really fill in where their needs aren't being met, and we find opportunities to help them with preserving and managing their cultural sites. And we have a master teacher for the Clark County School District, because we have a curriculum as well that we developed that is a very simple curriculum to work in schools that don't have as many resources, because in Nevada, we don't have a textbook on Nevada history that is up to date.
Wow.
Yes. Yeah. We have a curriculum that's easy, and it's everything they need. It's taught to the standards so they can fill out their rubrics and stuff. So
who did the curriculum?
That was our master teacher, Laura Tremani. And she's actually, I think, going for her doctorate in education.
Does that cover sort of Native American issues, including rock art and cultural heritage preservation elements?
We made it as simple as possible, because we do not have the best record as a school district. So they don't have as many resources or time.
Of course, of course. Yeah.
So we made it like, you know, but there's a bonus lesson at the end that talks about things that our organization is passionate about.
Yeah, yeah.
And it does talk about the different tribes. It cuts out the caricatures. It brings actual photographs. It talks about how the tribes are not gone. They're not in the past. They're here.
Well, this
today.
Is awesome. This is really awesome. That's excellent. Yeah. Is the curriculum designed for what level of education? Is it grammar school? Is it junior high school?
They learn about a history in fourth grade.
Oh, so fourth grade. Okay.
Fourth, fifth, and it's taught to those particular standards, or it's written for those standards. And it's just PowerPoints and some handouts that they can print directly. It's all black and white, you know, keep it as far as the handouts, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Keeping it real. So.
Well, you know, in terms of my own experience, I guess I'll give you some parallels. Here in California, the federally recognized Native American tribes are, of course, very, very active in having TIPOs, you know, traditional heritage preservation officers for those tribes. And then they develop divisions within their operations that work as Native American monitors, right? So, and those Native American monitors are paid sometimes very, very well for their time and talents, and work with archaeologists, especially if there's an excavation going on, etc. So I have been contracted personally to go to the tribes and teach the Native Americans about being Native American, believe it or not, and right. to teach them about the Native California Indian tribes, who they are, what they are, what we know about them, and what their culture was like, and then about, you know, the languages and the subsistence settlement systems. So there's that. But then there's, you know, teaching them what's archaeology, and what would the Native American, what they would be doing with their monitoring and safety, and, you know, very, very elaborate exercise that went on for days and days. It was a workshop, I believe, that went on for almost a week, that had, you know, these modules of information for them on many, many aspects of cultural heritage preservation activities. And so that was of interest. I've done that several times, mm-hmm. sometimes very truncated into an hour-long class, you know, when we trained 50 Native American monitors for a project I was involved in, that where we needed all these sites done. There was over 100 sites that were discovered, and they were constantly needing to develop some way of mitigating the adverse effects that would be taking place at those sites or on those sites with those sites, and dealing with some means of either collecting those artifacts on their surface or excavating the sites or covering them with fill and a geotextile and protecting them, on and on and on. So that was a project that was funded by a group of wind developers, wind energy developers, to the tune of about, I think it was about $5 or $6 million was, you know, expended on that particular, just on the cultural resources and that program alone. Now, the only other program that I've been involved with that was, you know, as complicated and as difficult and rather sensitive was in Oregon, where they had a mountain burned to the ground. And it was appropriately named Burnt Mountain. And they discovered over 100 archaeological sites on that mountain. And so they contracted with the archaeologists to identify them and evaluate them, and in some cases, at least test them to see if we can get some sense of how big they were and whether there was any subsurface material. And in other cases, if the site was large enough and important enough to collect the surface material that might be time or culturally diagnostic, and write a survey report and do some analysis about all these artifacts and work with the native people on questions of significance and heritage preservation, etc. That particular project has gone on. I'm a senior author of the monograph, which is probably 5,000 pages long. And that project was funded to the tune of about $8 or $9 million.
And it's interesting because it's so difficult when you had to boil things down to an hour.
Or oh, yeah.
Put it together in a school curriculum. There's so much you want to cover that you feel like you're not giving everything the attention that it deserves. And as you said, you know, these other larger projects, you know, 5,000 page document. It's like I have to boil that down into like two slides.
Yeah, it's like when you attend these archaeological conferences, right? Mm-hmm. Society for California Archaeology, the Great Basin Anthropological Conference, or whatever. And they say, well, you know, we'll give you 10 minutes to make your PowerPoint presentation, right?
Yeah.
10 minutes, right? And how can you possibly discuss anything in a 10-minute time span to cover, you know, a particular theme or project or subject that is so complicated? So you just the facts, ma'am. Just the facts.
Exactly. And so, I think that's, as a public, quote unquote, public archaeologist, I do that every day. I read large documents. I know all that background and history, but again, I got to give you a sound bite. I got to give you a small bit to grab your interest and hope you'll want to learn more.
But, exactly.
Bring it to that eighth grade level and see where it goes from there. So
what would you like to say to the general public and the audience of the only rock art podcast in the world as a sign off, Rayette?
I'd like to say, get out there and explore, report damages that you find, and help protect these amazing places for future generations, wherever you are in the world.
Amen to that. God bless you. See you on the flip flop, gang.
Thanks for listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. Find show notes and contact information at www.arcpodnet.com/rockart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast with your family and friends. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.